Hello, Mr. Joe Steele. Are you on mute?
Hello, Governor.
Oh, when are you going to learn how to use that mute button?
Never, because I just don't care.
Oh, how are you?
Tired. It's hot. It's so hot. We're having a heat wave here.
Yeah, it's autumn. It's 102 degrees here today.
Yeah. I didn't even look to see what it was. All I know is I turned off the AC and it immediately turned to oven temperatures in here.
Yeah, it's a swamp in our backyard. It's like 40% humidity and just like all of the mosquitoes are in my backyard.
I didn't even know it was wet enough there for mosquitoes.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, for a couple days, just covered in mosquito bites. The second you go out there, since apparently they're only around for like a week out of the year, that they have to get all of their consuming of our blood in immediately.
It's exciting.
It's not. They make their way into the house, and then you can't fall asleep because they're buzzing around your face, and it's just miserable.
Oh, it's only 93 degrees here, according to forecast.io.
Yeah. Yep. You still use the web app?
Yeah. Well, no. I was using DuckDuckGo as an experiment, and apparently that is what they source for their stuff.
Are you the one who always shows up in my referrals as DuckDuckGo? Like, who uses that nonsense?
I don't ever Google for you. So it's something
I had
else.
A referral to my main website a couple days ago from like the equivalent of like the AAA auto care service in Australia. Like I couldn't remotely figure out how that happened, but some like automotive help service linked to my site somehow.
Well, you never know when you're going to need to know Node Graph script stuff about things.
No, that was my main page. Oh. with my videos on it.
Oh, why would anyone go there?
I have no idea. It was like one of the two hits.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, so much has happened since we last talked.
Yes.
How's your XOXO?
It was fine. I went to the Hollywood Bowl, Simpsons at the Bowl, Take the Bowl thing, the event. And they had, even, like, animated some things specific to it, and some of the voice actors were there, including Hank Azaria, who I was happy to see again today.
Yeah, I didn't warn you about that.
No, it was a surprise.
Yeah.
Not my favorite Hank Azaria movie, but...
It's not really the main character.
No, yeah, it's a good figure.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know the Simpsons Bowl was a thing until I saw your photos.
I had no idea either. It was one of those things where I was trying not to go at all, and then it was like, oh, let's really go to this one, so I went. And the fireworks were not spectacular.
Well.
Yeah.
But you're enough of a Simpsons fan that you enjoyed it, apparently, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they even had Hans Zimmer came out and performed on the piano and conducted and stuff, although I don't really care for Hans Zimmer very much. like they just did the Spider Pig, which is just Spider-Man with different words, but
they brought out Hans Zimmer just to do Spider Pig.
Yeah, and his music from the beginning of the Simpsons movie when Bart's skateboarding naked through the town. That like chase music that they have in there.
I did not know that.
Yep. Oh, that was exciting.
Yeah, I don't watch the Simpsons.
The rest of it was all Alf Clausen stuff from the actual show. So.
Did you say Alf?
His name is apparently Alf Clausen.
Is it short for Alfred, I would hope?
I would imagine.
Like that subpar app launcher you use? Oh, I got a new kettle.
That's exciting.
It is.
What are you doing with the kettle?
I'm using it to make coffee.
Mm.
There was a little bit of rust on the inside of mine because I went and looked after you told me. And I was really sad about it. But then I went and like looked around to see if I could replace just the kettle part since it sits on that little electric base. And it turns out the rust was a known problem back then. And I guess they fixed it on newer models. So I sent them an email. I said, hey, can I have a new one even though it's way past the warranty? And the lovely folks at Bonavita sent me a new one.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it was. I got a new toy. Same as the old toy, except not rusty.
Mm-hmm. Same as it ever was.
I think that's a Who song.
Mm-mm. Okay, so so buttons. How was your XOXO?
I was good. I made some hats for some people, some artisanal hats.
I saw those. Those were quite lovely.
Yeah, they could have used a little bit more work, but, you know, my rule of not spending more than 5 or 10 minutes on it. I think I went 10 minutes because it was 5 minutes per hat, and, you know, I got distracted by, my cousin bought a Mac, finally, and I've been doing tech support for him.
It sounds so distracting.
It's incredibly distracting. I was helping him stitch PDFs together in Preview, which is not a good idea.
No.
I may have had to buy him a copy of PDF Pen Pro.
It's exciting.
No.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Smile Software.
I love Smile Software.
I know. That was a joke.
Did you see Detention is on Netflix? Did we talk about that? We talked about it offline, but
yeah, we talked about it on Twitter.
Your favorite movie, Detention, is now on Netflix for everyone to go watch.
favorite's a different word than the word. That was coming to my brain.
So great. It's just the best movie ever.
No, I hate it. it's awful. But speaking of high school experiences, there are some high school experiences in a certain movie.
We have more follow-up. I have more things.
Oh, wait. What?
There's been so much that's happened since we last talked.
Like what? It was a week. We don't do anything.
We bought iPhones. We bought lots of iPhones.
Oh, nobody wants to hear about that. 64 Space Gray. All right.
Everybody bought 64 Space Grays. Literally everyone, including me.
Yeah.
I went to Neater's for lunch today. Thought that was a good follow-up.
Okay.
I had a Reuben. I mean, well, they called it a Reuben. It wasn't really a Reuben. It's just some terrible flattened panini. I didn't know that you could make a Reuben panini.
I'm confused. So, can you explain the exact contents and preparation of this sandwich?
It appears that they just took, like, one slice of, I mean, it was hard to tell what the meat was because it was very flattened from being a panini, and a little bit of cheese and some sauerkraut, and they just mashed the hell out of it on some rye bread in a panini press. And, you know, it wasn't even crisp or anything. It was just kind of soggy. And I had that for my lunch today.
That's kind of revolting.
It was not great. I mean, it's certainly no Cantor's. Made me very sad.
Yeah. Well, I like Nate and Al's out here. I've never actually been to Cantor's.
You've never been to Cantor's?
Nope.
The wonderful deli that is not that far from you and has been there for, what, like 100 years?
I don't know. Have you ever been to Nate and Al's?
I've never heard of Nate and Al's.
Well, then, there.
Is it like Nate and Owl?
No. Nate, N apostrophe, Al's, as in Alfred.
Oh, Al, okay.
Yeah, Nate and Al's.
Well, the apostrophe N doesn't really help. Is that in or on or and?
It's an and. It's an abbreviation for and, like mac and cheese.
Oh, mac and cheese is good. Do you put hot sauce in your mac and cheese?
Sometimes.
What hot sauce do you prefer?
Well...
Within the context of mac and cheese, let me stipulate.
Okay. I would say for... That I would probably go with horrible acid sriracha, just because the cheese mellows it. But Cholula is also good too, and I like Cholula more with eggs though.
Hmm. I agree. I'm a Cholula Tapatio person for the mac and cheese, but sriracha for other things.
Yep.
Do you even want to talk about the Ion thing?
Oh no, I don't think it's worth mentioning. I've never used Fusion in my life.
Oh, boo.
But you learned on Fusion, right? Like that was your first? It was your first love?
It was my first love. It wasn't my first, air quotes, node-based compositor. That would be Combustion, even though it was a liar of a node-based compositor.
Explain liar.
It was a layer-based system. They just had this like view that you could sort of look at it as nodes, but it didn't have any of like the procedural abilities of a node-based compositor, really. It's basically if you just like took After Effects then added this little drop-down window that showed you the relationships in a node-based sort of way, and you could remove things or add things, but you couldn't like do the things that node-based apps do.
So it's just like, here's a flowchart of your layers.
Yeah, it was a great way to crash the app, is you look at the flowchart of your layers and then it goes away.
Oh boy.
But yeah, I used Fusion for a couple of years. It was my first node-based compositor.
My first was a Shake 2.5, I believe.
You went right into Shake, did you?
Yeah.
Was that in a real job or for fun?
Oh, no, that was at school. We had Shake 2.5 for Windows, because nothing real software made a Windows version, and then Apple bought them, and then they were stuck with being someone that made software for Windows, and then they discontinued the Windows version, but had to keep the Linux version for places that were actually doing work, because you could not have ever sold that product as a Mac-only product without losing 98% of the people using the software.
I did not realize there was a Windows version of it ever.
Yes, there was a Windows version. Because it was actually for Windows before it was for Mac. Apple bought them, and then that's when they made the Mac version of Shake.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. Oh, you know what? You just reminded me. The first Node-based compositor I ever saw was not actually Combustion or Fusion. It was a program called Raze, R-A-Y-Z. Are you familiar with it?
I'm not familiar with that.
Silicon Imaging. I saw it in high school. Some cousin of my video teacher was a compositor, and I thought it was like magic. He explained rotoscoping, and I thought it was the coolest thing ever, where he drew lines around people and turned like half of the frame black and white and half in color, and it was mind-blowing. And I think that they got bought by Apple as well and rolled into Shake at some point, but I don't think it got past like a 1.1. I still have a copy of it somewhere. It's Windows only, but it's just utterly baffling interface.
No, I didn't use it. And let's see, Aftershake professionally, the first thing I used was a proprietary piece of software, which was like a step backwards from Shake. It was very strange. It was like a, you know, like you see those old screenshots of like SGI workstations, where they have like that really thick beveled gray UI for everything. Yes. And then like scorching yellow text.
My first NAB, SGI was still around and making those like end table sized computers for compositing.
I don't understand that. All right. Well, next piece of follow up.
I just can't stop laughing at Chad Chatterton.
Oh,
that's not worthy. I found a bunch of comic books that reminded me that I used to read comic books. Did you see? You don't go on Tumblr anymore, do you?
No, I abandoned it out of furious rage.
I found a bunch of my Marvel cards. They weren't the ones I was looking for, but I found a bunch of Marvel cards and all of the, I don't know if you were a comic book reader back in 1992, but all of the Death of Superman stuff.
I didn't care about that. I was not back then I was not a DC person. I was a Marvel person because I like the Marvel cartoons.
For sure. I agree with that entirely. I just looking back, it was weird because once they killed him, they rebooted him like almost immediately. And there were like eight different Supermans, but like one of them was like an android, like half robot person. One of them was like this little teenager kid. There's tons of like really weird ones, and they were all going at the same time. And I have copies of all of them.
I remember that. And there was the blue one and the red one and.
It's very strange.
All kinds of stuff. Yeah.
There's one super like 90s hipstery looking one with like round dark sunglasses and like a Kyle Seth Gray haircut. It's very strange. But yeah, I found my Marvel cards. I have a lot of Wolverine cards and a lot of Punisher cards. And a lot of football cards, apparently.
This is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to go down to the swap meet and
sell them?
Yeah.
No, I have a couple autograph pictures from the Phoenix Suns back in those days, which will probably be worth nothing. But
the Phoenix Suns a team?
It's a basketball team.
Oh.
Yeah, you can see the delineation.
Are they still a team?
Yes, they're still a team.
Okay.
From like 92 to like 93 in this box of stuff, it goes from like Marvel cards to like baseball and basketball cards.
Hmm.
My dad used to buy like the full box of cards that you could see like at the grocery store with like the unopened packages, and he wanted to like save it unopened for a long time. And I guess he just realized now that he was like sorting through this stuff that I went through and I opened every pack of cards and looked through them to see if I knew any of the people, and then I put them back in the little plastic sleeve and back in the box and pretended like they weren't open.
Dan.
I couldn't resist. I wanted to open the cards and look at them.
Dan.
I did the same thing to you remember in the 90s where the Beatles released that anthology CD thing?
Yeah, but I was not a Beatles person, so I don't really care.
Yeah, it was a little bit, and I guess he had intended to just save that for all eternity unopened, but I totally opened it and started playing it one day, and he got super mad. Walk down memory lane in some banker's boxes in my dad's attic. I'm watching his dog while he's out of town for a little while.
What kind of dog is it?
It's a Cocker Spaniel. He's had Cocker Spaniels pretty much for my entire life. You're not a dog person, are you?
I'm not really an anything person. I don't want anything.
Don't like dogs, cats, people.
No. I don't want to be around anything that's going to take attention away from me. So there's that.
You've been in Hollywood too long.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be, you know, second billing to some mutt.
You want to play second banana to a dog?
Mm-hmm. That's what the kids are there for, the dog.
Wait, kids?
I don't know.
Oh.
Well, I figured, you know, four quadrant picture kind of a thing. I mean, what else would I be in?
I don't know. I thought we were talking about bananas.
Oh.
Bananas. I've been listening to so much Bionic. I'm on Bonanza now.
Oh. Okay.
They're coming for you.
No. It's the fire department. They wouldn't come for me yet.
You're on fire today.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not. But I might be in maybe an hour from now.
You've completely melted in your chair.
Yes. As this oven of an apartment fully heats to maximum.
Yeah, I'm tucked away in my blanket fort again.
That sounds just abysmal. I can't even imagine being tucked away inside of a blanket fort in this heat.
It's not pleasant, but then again, it's never pleasant around here.
I can't imagine it would be.
Just paid my $400 air conditioning bill.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and it's still warm in here. I think I'm out of follow-up.
Good.
Are we just not having fun today? I know it's a Monday.
I've got a case of the Mondays.
Me too. I'm seeking refuge in this podcast because from like 7 a.m. to like 11 a.m. I was just emails with just disgruntled people. Oh, boy. But you watched the movie this morning.
Oh, yeah. I watched the movie. And not to spoil it, but overall, good movie. I have never seen it before in my life.
I'm glad we could offer you some culture.
I feel like I've been sufficiently educated. It's not my favorite movie.
No.
But it is a movie, and it has things in it that are good, and it has things in it that are not great, but are fine.
So what parts... I guess we should mention that we're talking about Gross Point Blank.
No, leave him guessing.
Leave him guessing. We'll just see if we can get 45 minutes into the podcast before people can guess. Well, first person to guess, call in and give us your answer as to what movie we're talking about, and you win a free prize pack and $15 off your next order at Hover.com.
Well, see, I actually did a guessing game the other day when you were asleep and not responding to our brand's engagement.
I was not asleep. I was just occupied.
I'm not going to ask. And so...
I don't remember.
So, Rob Lewis was inquiring about what we were going to cover, and I gave him the wonderful little riddle of blank is on a mission, but his mission is not the main driver, capital D, of this 97 movie. And his answer was Drive.
I mean, I like Drive. It's a good movie. But no.
No.
Yeah, the character doesn't even have a name in that move.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Rob.
Yes. Thank you, Rob. That was funny.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We love you. Mm-hmm. Please keep listening to our show.
And
I don't think we can really afford to alienate our audience.
I we have an audience? No,
there's like four.
Literally dozens. Four. Dozens of listeners. But the movie's fine. And, you know, it opens pretty well, I think. It is very 90s, but it is very late 90s. So it's not... it doesn't have the montage-y, like, strangeness of some of the other things we've reviewed on here before.
You mean it's a movie in the 90s that doesn't try to be 90s, and it's actually made like a movie instead of made like 90s pop culture nonsense?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pop culture in here, but it's actually mostly 80s pop culture, but...
Yes. Because the premise of the movie being that he's going back to his high school reunion from 1986, so it kind of, you know, goes with the theme a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to state for the record ahead of time that this is one of my favorite movies. It's on the Netflix for the kids in the audience, but I have it in my iTunes, and I have for a very long time. And for me, this movie is probably about as quotable as Super Troopers, because there are dozens of lines in it that I just adore and say over and over again in my daily life. Not like out loud as like affirmations or anything, just, you know.
You don't have them, you haven't embroidered them on anything hanging in your house?
I'm not really a knitter.
There's no needlework, no needlepoint.
No needlepoint. I don't think I have needles. I mean, I could probably use this pen if I needed to. But
yeah, like in prison. just like in that first episode of Oz. Moving right along,
or like in the climax of this film. I just realized the pen that I'm holding looks surprisingly like the pen that propels us into the third act of this movie. But anyway, What are things that you like about this movie? Is this really one that you want to go through scene by scene, or you want to just talk about it?
Well, I think I'd briefly go through scene by scene, very briefly, as it is hot. So this will be a short show. We get the music with the titles over black, and it's I can see clearly now the rain is gone, and we cut in. The first thing we see is him with eye drops. So that's actually kind of amusing when you think about the song lyrics. I can see clearly, and then it's for eye drops so he can shoot somebody. Because he's going to snipe from his Los Angeles hotel room in downtown, which just sounds miserable. Like, I can't even imagine the bugs in that place.
You know, cleverness aside, there are a number of good music cues, I think, in this movie.
Yeah, there's only one music cue that I hate.
The song itself or where it happens?
Both.
You know what? I think I know what it is, and I think I'm going to feel the exact opposite about it, but we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm. And so buttons, moving right along to him on the phone with his sister, Joan Cusack. Who's not his sister at all in the movie, but his secretary.
And probably the worst actor in the movie, if I might say.
Shut your mouth. She was my favorite.
In this movie? Are you kidding me?
Yes.
She has some great parts, but like her delivery is just so like, come on. Anyway.
She's so over the top that it's lovely. I'll get to all of her amazing stuff that happens later, but this opening scene is not it.
She is a fantastic character where in this opening scene, she just like in the middle of their discussing their order for bullets, she starts reading him his invitation to the high school reunion.
Yes, as he's preparing to shoot someone. Right.
little busy right now. No, just take a second, I promise.
It's pretty good. There's one weird thing that happens twice in this movie, and that is Dutch angle, which is the German angle. It happens here with her shot.
Just say a Dutch angle is a German angle?
Well, I mean, it's from German directors. People just called it Dutch, like Pennsylvania Dutch. They're not really Dutch. They're German. Anyway, look it up. Look it up on Wikipedia, kids. So they shoot it at an angle where it's tilted, so the floor is not parallel to the camera, which doesn't make any sense, because I don't know why you would do that in the scene, because why? She's sitting at a desk.
Yeah.
And so they do it again later on in the movie for the office. And that's the only other time they use it, and so I don't know why they do it. But that bugged me. We get the shot of the guy on the bike, and his arm flails out, and then he gets shot. And then while John Cusack is putting away his stuff, we get introduced to another gentleman the doorman who shoots up everybody else really violently.
Dan Aykroyd with his six shooters that have never-ending rounds of bullets.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing, really.
that's the one criticism about this movie that I will admit to, is that the guns never run out of bullets until it's a plot point.
Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of movies do that, so it's kind of hard to fault this one particular movie. But I mean,
except for the part where they actually like need guns to run out of bullets for a point, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But lots of movies do that. And we get the lovely scene of them being introduced shortly after that, where they're where he says he's in Budapest, and he's like, "Oh no, I'm actually here." And he drives up, and they have their little conversation where they're sort of standing off with one another, but they're chit chatting about unions. And I love it; it's fantastic that it's just sort of this banal evil of assassination work.
Yeah, it's a business. And the thing I like about it is the first scene is fine by itself, but if you combine that scene and this scene, you learn so much about these characters and the world they live in just so quickly that it's fantastic. You learn about Martin's relationship with Marcella, his assistant, and just the way they go back and forth. And then you realize that he knows Dan Aykroyd's character just when he's peering out that window as he's failing at his job because he took over. And then you get the actual story about their history. But the way they talk about it is not like expository. It's just like, hey, you remember that time with the thing and, you know, the little stabber girls, and they do that thing because they clearly have a common dialogue, even though we have no idea what they're talking about. We understand that they have like history together, and it's just fun to watch.
Yes, it is. And
there's just so much depth to the character and the scenes. I love it.
A lot of that I have to credit Dan Aykroyd with. He is very interesting on screen, especially when he's delivering these lines, which, you know, could go wrong if you had miscast this role. If somebody was playing that seriously, with Dan Aykroyd, he's never serious, so it actually works out really well.
Yeah, and I should stipulate, like, as you go through this, I'm just going to stop you from time to time because, like, more than half of my notes on this movie are just quotes that I love, and that scene where they meet together is one of my first favorite quotes. Is where Dan Aykroyd like starts to get threatening at the end there. He's like, "Cause one way or another, I'm gonna get you." Just my favorite quote from John Cusack is, "Get what? Get back." And then they just go about their business.
I think that worked better in context, but
all quotes work better in context, but that's the point.
Mm-hmm. Quote. But it's great. And then we get the job that he botches.
No, wait. But like, what? Right as soon as at the end of this scene, he's like, he's thinking about this meeting he just had with Dan Aykroyd. He sits back down in his car. His phone rings, and it's Joan Cusack finishing reading the 10-year high school reunion flyer to him. And he's just, "Stop it. Don't ever read that to me."
Okay.
Love that part. He just answers the phone, and she keeps reading it to him. Just like, she's this nagging. It does feel like she's his sister in parts of this, and it's fantastic.
Yes. All right. And so then we get the botched second assassination. So we clearly are starting to understand that he is not on his game here. But he is still quite threatening in that he does actually kill the guy rather dramatically by jumping downstairs and doing stuff, kicking in a door. We get the sense from him that it's not personal, it's just business.
Or at least that's what he's telling himself.
Yeah. And then he finally makes his way back to his office and talks to Marcella in person. And she's concerned that he is getting off of his game and that it would probably be a good idea for him to go to his high school reunion, try and get in touch with his roots, and that she's fascinated that he came from somewhere.
Yes. Another great line. Yes. I find it amusing that you came from somewhere. Goodbye.
She's good.
It's a good scene though, when he's just leafing through his magazine and like looking at his lamp, just trying to avoid having her come in and talk.
Mm-hmm. In her Sergeant Pepper blazer coat thing. I don't even know what that was.
It's just great that like they have these weird, these somewhat odd character affectations, but they don't just let them slide by. Like the people poke fun at each other as if they were real people, and I love that.
Mm-hmm. And then so he agrees to take on the second job, which will coincidentally be at his high school reunion.
Well, in Detroit.
Yes. We get the... And Marcella's all excited about that because she's like, "Oh, it must be fate." And then we get introduced to your favorite character in the movie, Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin. Oh, my God. He's so great.
Yeah. Although it kind of bugged me when they first introduced him, because we aren't actually introduced to him. We're introduced to John Cusack directly addressing the camera, mm-hmm. which is very annoying to me. But at least we didn't like pan around his head to reveal Alan Arkin. We just cut to Alan Arkin. That's
yeah,
fine.
It was an odd directorial choice where they kind of did a faux fourth wall thing and then cut to Arkin, who was clearly just disinterested, staring at his desk with his head in his hands.
Yeah. Oh, and I just love it that we clearly established that while Martin thinks that this is his psychologist doesn't think that he's the psychologist. He said that he couldn't see him anymore.
Yeah.
And we get the whole like backstory here that he's not comfortable at all with this relationship and does not approve of it and doesn't want to be involved in any way. but he's sort of involved against his will, and we get the passive threat against him and his family.
Because he just keeps showing up every week.
Yeah.
As if he had an appointment.
He's like, you know, I'm supposed to go to the police. And he's like, you wouldn't do that. I know where you live. He's like, well.
Oh, that wasn't supposed to make me feel good.
Yeah.
Now I got to be creative in some really interesting way or Mark's going to blow my brains out.
Yep.
I just love Alan Arkin in general, but I think this is a role that just fit perfectly for him.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed how little he's in the movie, but he does an amazing job in every scene he's in.
Yeah, it's just a testament to how much more we want him. Like, as soon as he leaves at the end of that scene, Alan Arkin just goes, oh, just exasperated, just in typical Arkin style, just, I can't stop laughing. Like, when he's taking the nap, like, he doesn't even do anything in that scene. He takes a nap, he's walking over to pick up the phone, and the answering machine kicks on, and he can hear that it's Martin. He's like, nope, not touching it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go lay back down. And he's basically just putting his hands over his ears, going like, ah, shut up, you.
And then we get his promise to Dr. Oatman that he will not kill anybody this weekend. And then we're off to Detroit and to Grosse Pointe, a suburb of Detroit.
Yes. Did you look that up?
No.
It
was just obvious from the thing.
The one thing about this movie that is distinctly late 90s, in my opinion, is the title, Grosse Pointe Blank, it being the place he's from and his last name. It's just this odd amalgamation of things from the movie that really doesn't make any sense.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure what else they would have called it, though. I think there was an original title. I have a copy of the script, which I don't even want to bring up because, like, I don't know where I found it, but it starts completely differently. But, like, it starts with an assassination, but it's on, like, a golf course and something, and it's very not as good as this movie is. And based on the fact that there are, like, four writers credited, one of which is John Cusack, I want to say this probably went through a lot of script revisions before it came out the other side.
Yeah, because the one guy got the story credit, was, I think, the first author on the screenplay, and then it was polished up by two other people, and then John Cusack got to weigh in on it.
Did this come from a book? Do we know?
I don't think so. I think there was a story credit, but it was just like the story idea credit, not a story book credit. But moving right along, we get our aerial shots set to classical music, not classical, but older music of the time period, and we establish sort of the geography of things, of the like little town center where the radio free Grosse Pointe is, with our DJ, who we only see the lips of at first, and that's Minnie Driver. And she clearly makes eye contact with our protagonist, and he clearly makes eye contact with her, and so it's like, oh, I wonder if they have some unresolved past history between them, and maybe they do.
Well, he hears her on the radio, and apparently that's how he learns where she is. And then he just decides to be a creeper and cruise by and park outside with his glasses and hat on and his gloved hand covering his face.
He is such a creeper in this movie.
I love that even though he's driving, I assume he rented the car, but like he's got to wear his leather gloves because can't lay fingerprints anywhere. Got to be a professional about it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he wears black all the time.
Well, I thought that was more of a character affectation than a career affectation.
Because
he's depressed.
I think one of the first high school dances I went to, I dressed in all black, just like this character.
Because no one understood your feelings, Dan?
No, just because I thought it was a cool look.
Oh. Yeah, no.
You could tell I've liked this movie for a long time.
Oh, Dan.
It was not a high school reunion. I did not go to my high school reunion. But now I kind of regret it. I could have stabbed somebody with a pen.
Oy vey. So,
moving right along, he's back in his hometown visiting some people, and he's clearly enamored with this idea of, like, at least not even necessarily getting back to his roots, but like separating from a moment from this life that he's not super into at the moment, because he basically ignores the whole job that he's supposed to be doing there, as noted by Joan Cusack when she calls saying, like, is it done? He's like, nah, I'll do it tomorrow. And, you know, he's preoccupied seeing all his old friends and running around town and seeing the fact that his house is now turned into a convenience store.
The Ultimart.
The Ultimart. Great, great scene. Like, I think the writing in this movie is fantastic. Like, it's hilarious to me that his house was turned into a convenience store, in which you get another line that I love. Can never go home again, Oatman, but at least you can shop there. To which Alan Arkin just groans and rolls over on the couch.
Well, while he's saying that to Dr. Oatman, do you know what's behind him?
Oh, is it the scene where he's already in a session? He's like smashing the phone, trying to get it to shut up.
No. That's later. What's behind John Cusack's character in the convenience store?
A great number of things. Are you talking about the video game?
No, that's when he's talking to the clerk.
The Pulp Fiction cutout, then.
No.
What's behind him?
Zima.
Why would you choose to single out Zima?
Because it was right behind his head. It's a blue box that says Zima on it.
It's a convenience store. They have beer and Zima, apparently, in the freezer.
I know. It just cracked me up. Because, I mean, how 90s could that be? I mean, Zima.
Yeah. That was like pre the terrible drinks that we used to drink, the Smirnoff Ices and the what have you. That was the original awful sugary garbage.
I've never actually had a Zima.
It's basically like the one bland flavor of Smirnoff Ice. It's just disgusting.
Delicious. All right. But yes, and it's also interesting, some of the other stuff in the convenience store, like the video game cabinet that we linger on in that shot. And I'm like, well, why are we paying so much attention to that? And of course it comes up later, because otherwise they wouldn't probably have framed the shot that way. But it's a Doom 2 cabinet. So that was fascinating to me.
And he's got the, what is that gun that shoots like the plasma rifle? Is that what they called it in the game?
I don't remember. I didn't really get a good look at that gun. Probably.
It's the one that shoots the blue electric looking stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it was an odd scene. Just the what are you doing here? Just grilling the guy behind the counter, who's clearly concerned for his safety, because this random stranger is accusing him of something and wants to know where he lives, just because he's losing his shit in his head and trying to rationalize how his house turned into a convenience store.
Yeah, and then he gets in touch with his secretary, who finds out where his mom is, and she is inside of some sort of a care facility, and it's kind of pretty sad, actually. She's not doing well.
There are serious moments in this movie, but right before we transition into that scene, he's on the phone, and we see the CIA guys, Hank Azaria, and what's the other gentleman's name?
Kenneth.
Kenneth.
Todd Freeman. I mean, that's not his act. That's not the actor.
Todd Freeman's. Yeah, they pull up and they're spying at him through the window. And I just love that. Again, it's these being like real characters. He says, "Any idea how you want to wax this guy?" And Hank Azaria just says, "Can you just say kill? Why do you got to romanticize everything?" And they're just like, "Nope, go." And they drive away so they don't get spotted. But like, I love that all of the people in this movie are real people, and they're just great, great, great lines.
And I think I put this out of place, but there was, of course, the scene with Dan Aykroyd chatting in some sort of a IRC client.
Using his little those little cheek muscle exercisers. Did you recognize that's what that was?
No, I didn't know what that was.
It was a thing in the 90s. Remember, it was like a late night infomercial of a thing that you put in between the side of your mouth and you squeeze in. It was supposed to be like exercise for your cheeks to keep your face like face tight. And completely ridiculous. That's what he spits out on his keyboard when he's typing. Completely ridiculous.
Yes. Well, that's how he finds out that his job has gone to someone else, and then that, of course, turns out to be John Cusack. And he is none too happy and will organize things against him. So after the sad scene, he goes and he visits his father's grave and pours whiskey out on it, and he goes to visit Minnie Driver at the radio station.
Yeah, and I want to just stop again and say, like, those scenes, as benign as like most of the dialogue was, it just like adds so much more understanding and depth about this character. You just learned so much about him in these like two quick little scenes.
Yeah.
I'd love the writing in this movie.
Well, I mean, it sets it up that there's clearly something not great in his past, which also might have been part of the reason why he wanted to leave, that he can't deal with things around here and he hasn't been back. So there's something that sets up sort of a reluctance here, with his mother and her situation and his dead father. So then with Minnie Driver, that's the first time that's the first time they've seen one another or talked to one another in 10 years. They've had no other contact. And she's quite cross and concerned about why he abandoned her.
Well, I love the fact that, like, the moment they see each other, they go right into, like, staring each other down and then kissing for a minute because, like, there's nothing that can prevent them from just having that that moment where they realize how much they miss each other. But then, yeah, she snaps out of it and just goes right back into, where the hell have you been?
I thought the kissy stuff was kind of phony. There are a few phony kissy moments in here where it's just like...
It's a movie, but I thought it was an interesting way to start the introduction to their relationship.
I mean, it does... I think that you could have established everything without having that moment. Like, literally change nothing else except not have them kiss, and then it would have established exactly the same stuff.
I think it adds a little bit more credibility, too, when she starts, like, sassing him over the radio after he's left and calls him, you know, former love of my life. It's like... Okay, you get a little bit of the background that they clearly had more than just a silly high school relationship, and the fact that it's this dramatic for the both of them 10 years later. I mean, for him, for sure, because he just bailed on everything he's ever known on prom night. But, you know, why would she still care 10 years later unless it was like a really serious relationship and they really had something, you know, phony baloney movie relationships?
Blah. And
it's not realistic, but I'm saying it's like that idyllic relationship that they don't have to necessarily explain the backstory of, but we get hints of it through things like that, which is something that I like about this movie.
Yeah, I guess, but I didn't find the motivation sufficient for the action, but it's hardly, I didn't even mention it, which is why it's, you know, not really that big of a deal for me as an objection. And but we do get the interesting moment with Hank Azaria and his partner Kenneth in the car outside while they're calling into the radio station to further sass John Cusack when he comes back and is on air with her, which was actually kind of entertaining, just to see Hank Azaria getting a kick out of something that he really shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah. Like, you basically just let him know that you're following him around, because who else is going to call and say that? But it was funny because it's bored guys on a stakeout, and they wanted to give him some crap.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. It was very nice. And then we run into Jeremy Piven.
Oh, wait. One of my favorite things is when Minnie Driver, like, goes to the phones asking for callers to see, like, what they think about this whole relationship. And the dude basically just says, I don't know, man, and I'd make him wear that prom dress. I'd love that. Just imagine if you were on the radio with your former boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, and they just, in your hometown, and they started giving you crap on the radio, and everyone you knew heard it because it was a small city. What kind of nonsense would come through the phones? And again, this being the 90s when people listened to the radio and used telephones.
Yes. Well, radio free gross point.
This is also the 90s because this is Jeremy Piven pre delusional hair.
But it's still Jeremy Piven.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I enjoy Jeremy Piven from time to time.
Well, no, I know, but Jeremy Piven is always Jeremy Piven. Like, Jeremy Piven,
sure.
Jeremy Piven is not here to play anything other than Jeremy Piven.
This may as well be like PCU may have been like inserted in between their high school days and their now timeline in Gross Point Blank. Like, that's where he went for college and then he came back here for for this movie.
Oh man, PCU.
We should do that sometime. I love that movie. It's ridiculous though.
Love's a strong word. But we get introduced to his character who parks his Beamer in the red zone, half in the red zone, which I thought was fascinating since the street was empty. and then they go off to his real estate job so he can, Jeremy Piven's character can impress his out-of-town friend with how successful he is as a realtor. Yeah,
he's really not the brightest of characters, but, you know, high school friends, in retrospect, they weren't necessarily always the brightest.
Well, it's been 10 years. 10 years, man. 10 you years.
Know, I think they basically ran that scene like five different times, and the director just had him do it at all different levels of drama and just decided to play it twice. Like, I can't imagine that the script actually called for them to do that twice, but it really just feels like they were just like, all right, they really just shot that scene with faster and more intense until they got to that level, and they did the slow one and then the dramatic one, and they just cut them together.
Yeah, well, it almost felt like they asked him to do, like, a bunch of takes all in a row, and they would just pick the best one, but then they just kept the whole thing.
I mean, you always ask an actor, like, give me one that's over the top, and they did, and he's like, oh, I guess we'll use both, because why not?
Yeah, it's just it shouting works. 10 years.
Works in the cut. And then another one of my favorite lines is, he takes him by Debbie's house, and he goes, yeah, I kind of crept up on you, didn't you? No, you drove us here.
Oh, I feel bad. I missed something in my notes here. Which is the lovely scene with Terry, the rent-a-cop.
Yes. Oh, it's so great.
Yeah. How did you get the gig? Ah, you know, they were hiring. It was only a 2-week course.
I love it. He's like, what are you doing here, Terry? Oh, I saw some people milling around on the lawn. No, it was just me. It was just one guy. I was over there. Just like the character banter. I hope most of that was improvised because it's just so great. And there's just no way around. I mean, the writing, again, I love so many of the lines, just the scenes where these characters are just being ridiculous. And my dad always laughs at this scene because as Terry's all like, you know, bummed out and like drives away in his car, he hits this siren that makes one noise and then drives away real quick.
Yes.
Just woo, drives.
Yes. And Terry, poor Terry.
Yeah, who was apparently so down on himself, he ends up bringing his firearm to the high school reunion, to which John Cusack just kind of shakes his head at.
Mm-hmm.
And then right as John Cusack is getting out of the car after he had his fun little catch-up with Jeremy Piven, another one of my favorite lines, Jeremy Piven says, see you later at the F Peak and I'm kidding myself party, because how on the nose is that for a high school reunion?
Yeah. Although he doesn't seem to realize that it applies to him. But at least the character doesn't seem to.
You know, I mean, he can't help that he's still got the hots for Jenny Slater.
Oh, boy.
Did the precious metals paper for you. Mm-hmm. 11 glasses with you. And I love that she just goes, oh, just turns and walks away as soon as she realizes who she is.
Mm-hmm. Wait.
Anyway.
Okay.
I fast forwarded.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then we get the call to Joan, where he wants to find out about the other people shadowing him because he's started to suspect something. And we get the lovely soup conversation.
Oh my god, I love the soup conversation.
I love it because she cuts away and she's still going on about the hollow point order with the other line, and she's shouting about it, and then she cuts back to talking about soup.
It's not gonna be a boring soup. Carrots and celery are just a base. Like, how great is it that she just flips between these two things where she's screaming at somebody about an order of 9mm hollow points, and then she's giving a soup recipe to one of her friends.
Yes, I love her character so much, and it's the thing I don't get is like how you can hate that. It's so wonderful, and it is so Joan Cusack.
No, she's a fantastic character, and it's just like in the opening scenes of this movie, her delivery is a little weird, but yeah, her character is. I mean, she's an incredibly diverse and deep character that is just completely off her nut, but she's a human being. She doesn't feel like a movie character, and I love it.
Mm-hmm. And then we go back to the Ultimart for a very interesting scene where the clerk is playing the Doom 2 cabinet with headphones on, which are like the most magical headphones in the world.
He's listening to some really loud Motorhead, man.
Of course. On
the Ace of Spades is a good jam.
Yes, on completely unpowered headphones. See, you totally wouldn't hear gunshots.
Well,
lots
yeah,
of gunshots.
I mean, you know, that anyone who's ever been around gunshots knows that there's a very loud percussion that you can feel as well as hear. So, yeah, obviously that's not. And the guy running around behind you with an Uzi shooting at a guy with two more pistols, you'd probably notice.
Yeah, the whole store was falling apart.
The smell of maybe the smoke in the air, but, you know, who knows?
Yeah, so we get our first introduction to an assassin set to assassinate
Mr. Felix LaPoubelle.
Yes. Although we don't get his name originally yet. He's just some angry guy.
At this point, he is the ghoul. Two spooks and a ghoul. I love that they have like slang or lingo for his industry too.
Yes. And so that happens. And there's C4 that goes in the microwave, which somehow the metal wires don't catch fire before the timer runs out. And then it, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. There was some little like, there was like a mercury thing in there that was bubbling. And maybe that's what made the connection. Who knows?
Well, technically, it would have like caught fire or something. It doesn't matter. Anyway, kaboom.
It was gray clay. And a very Cusack moment is where he sees it. And then he stares at it for a moment. Then he makes that just ridiculous face and then sprints out the door.
Yes, he's very, very John Cusack. Yeah. He does come back and rescue our poor idiot who can't figure out that he's been in a gunfight. And the guy is quite cross about it, about being rescued, because that was his job, man.
You're right. No, I'm hurt and pissed. Got to find a new job. And then I love as the building's exploding, John Cusack just sort of like props his head up on his fist and lays on the grass and watches the whole thing explode.
Mm-hmm.
And the CIA guys are in their car around the corner, and Kenneth just goes, cool. Like, they don't care. They're not going to do anything. They're there for one job, and they're like, nope, not going to be involved with this.
Yeah. Also, I thought they were NSA and not CIA.
Yeah, you know, same thing.
Yes, of course. So, Buttons, moving right along to... he calls Minnie and wants to meet at the Hippo Club. And so they meet at the Hippo Club. And
he's making this phone call while the building is exploding behind him and the fire department is on the way. And he's just like, on to the next thing.
Well, there was a weird shot in there, too. Did you notice that when he's on his cell phone, his big gray 90s cell phone, flip phone, and it cuts to part of the explosion where the enclosure for the payphone is still there? With fire behind it, and then it cuts back to him on his phone. I don't know why they cut to the burning phone.
I thought it was just because the Altamart sign fell off and bounced off the phone.
Oh, I didn't see that. But
yeah,
anyway.
The sign fell off the building, but yeah.
All right, well, they have the conversation.
But it's so clear, like, this is another one of the scenes where he goes, like, this is my screwed up life that I'm stuck in at the moment, but, like, I'm just going to completely, like, turn a blind eye to that, and I'm going to call Minnie Driver because I want to go talk to her again. And he's just, the world is literally crumbling around him. He's just like, let's try that again. We'll call Debbie back.
Seems like he has his priorities a little out of whack.
Yeah, he's not the most well-rounded or well-adjusted character, I should say.
No, certainly not. And he's nervous and that he has his back to the door, he's trying to think of what to say when she's pressing him for what he was actually doing. And we get Amy, the drunken friend who stumbles over and sort of ruins the scene because he was almost ready to tell Minnie Driver all of the details of his life, but now feels self-conscious about it in front of Amy.
I do like that at multiple instances in this movie, people ask what he's been doing, and he's actually honest with them, and none of them believe him. Mm-hmm. And he's basically, since he's bottomed out, and it's like, he doesn't even care anymore. He's so willing to be honest about these awful things he's done, and people just don't even give him the chance to open up and be, you know, be who he is now. They still have this idea of who he was, and he's just like, all right, I guess I'll play this role for a minute until eventually it gets serious later down the line. But I love that he keeps trying to tell people, and they keep joking about whether or not he gets dental insurance or whether he needs to do postgraduate work to be a professional killer.
Yes. Man. Because you wouldn't believe someone if they came up and said that to you. So why would anyone else in this movie believe it? So that's interesting. We move on to him going into the bathroom, and he runs into our NSA friends, and they just look right at each other, and he just says, oh, hi.
Yes.
Which is, it's a very nice scene.
Yeah, I love this scene in particular because they end up screwing with Dan Aykroyd again. He's like, oh, no, he's coming back. Get back in the stall. And they're just like, nah, he's not coming back. He's like, oh, screw you guys. Yes. I appreciate being holed. But they're just, you know.
This does establish an important relationship, though, between these corrupt NSA agents and Dan Aykroyd. that they are, he's like, oh, well, why don't you just off him? And he's like, well, we work for the government. We're not just going to like off somebody.
Yeah.
You know,
they do that a couple times. The, why don't we just do his job so we can do our job and get out of here? He's like, no, 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 that's not how it works. You want to be the good guy, but you can't do the bad guy's job. And they go back and forth with that. And it's, they're not so much corrupt as they are just like bored and looking for, like they're going out of their way to try and find this thing that they can bring back with their boss and be like, look at this cool thing we did. We've got, we took down a hitman who was in the middle of his thing, and maybe we can get a raise out of it. They're clearly like bored government workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we have the cat conversation. You don't know if it's a boy or a girl? I respect its privacy.
You don't know my cat.
Yes. And we go back to his hotel room, and he's talking to Joan Cusack again. And he's on his PowerBook 5300C, and she's on
I knew you were going to know exactly what that laptop was.
Well, I thought it was, but then I had to look it up. but it was. It was the 5300C. Hopefully not one of the models that had an exploding Sony battery. And then they... and she's on her Apple Vision monitor. It's very 90s Apple, and it's very funny to me that they went that route, which is, it's strange because at the beginning of the movie they're like on DOS machines or something, like with that weird interface she's using.
I mean, and not to mention the fact that John Cusack has like a fax machine in his briefcase in the car.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's very weird. I don't understand what that's about. But they and for some reason CIS Hollywood did effects in this movie, so I'm assuming that it's the digital inserts for these monitors.
I would have imagined they would have done those practically.
I don't know. I don't know what counts for digital in the 90s, but I don't know what else they would have done in the movie.
I can't think of any digital effects in this movie.
No. So I think it must have been the monitors. But the we get another scene, and she explains the whole thing of who the Basque guy is that came after him, who the NSA agents are, and their names. It seems like she's very connected. And then he goes to have breakfast with Dan Aykroyd in that little diner on the Main Street area of the town.
Well, you missed the part where he goes and sees Debbie again and gives her an airplane.
Oh, I didn't care.
No, it's just, again, one of my favorite lines, the, you're a psycho. And you imagine him to say, like, no, I'm not. But he says, don't rush to judgment on something like that until all the facts are in. And I just love how honest that moment is. He's like, yeah, I might be a psycho, especially in your opinion. But let's not ruin it just yet. Let's keep this facade going for a moment.
Well, she says that later on, too. She calls him a psycho another time. And he's like, I'm not a psycho because I kill for money. There's a difference. And so it comes up often. But the omelet scene's interesting.
He's brown bagging it today.
Yes. With Dan Aykroyd walking in with a brown lunch bag.
Yeah, and his hand in the bag.
Obviously does not have a gun in. Right. He sits down at the table with John Cusack, who has a white cloth napkin or a towel or something over his gun. And it's very obvious to anyone who looked at the situation that they both have guns.
Yeah, but for some reason, it's a small town. Nobody cares. Everyone's minding their own business.
Yeah, it seems totally normal. And the waitress comes over and rattles off a list of specials of different kinds of omelets that they have, and asks for their orders. And Dan Aykroyd places his strange order, and then John Cusack places his order and asks for an omelet with nothing in it. To which our waitress says that it wouldn't really be an omelet with
That's
nothing
not
in it.
Technically an omelet. And then, again, this is probably the line that I repeat most out of this movie in all facets of my life. I don't want to get into a semantic argument about it. I just want the protein. And then she just has that look on her face and just walks away.
You could say that in lots of situations, Dan.
let's keep it above the table there.
Yeah, like the guns.
What's the matter? Let Chef Raul put a little cilantro for your liver, little onions for the blood, and I'd love just... I don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you hear that, Kyle? We don't want cilantro in our omelets or our burritos.
I don't really think you should address him directly. It only encourages him. Other listeners who would like to provide feedback, please do so we don't have to keep mentioning Kyle.
He's the only one I know that likes cilantro.
There are lots of people that do. Otherwise, they wouldn't put it in everything. I think that there's just a conspiracy. Moving on from our cilantro conspiracy, we get him kicking around different ideas he could say at the reunion for what he does for a living. He's a pet psychiatrist. He's a couch insurance salesman. Unfortunately, he doesn't mention that he invented Post-its, which would have been the best thing to say at a high school reunion, in my opinion.
What?
You didn't see the movie.
What movie?
The movie. Don't worry. Ask Amanda later. She'll explain it.
Are you talking about... I know what you're talking about.
Yes, the other 1997 high school reunion movie, which had less gunfire. But moving on, we get the wonderful scene with Alan Arkin finally calling him back, eating a microwaved burrito on a paper plate with his little paper cup of coffee with the handles. Remember those kinds of cups with the little paper handles?
So great. You can probably still find them at the gas stations and hotel lobbies from time to time.
Oh yeah. It's just an amazing little prop for his character though. Like he's such a sad man.
He's Alan Arkin. He's fantastic.
I love it. And he's like, oh, don't kill anybody, et cetera, et cetera. We get John Cusack leaves, and we get the shot of somebody in the place, Minnie Driver's calling, and the phone's ringing, and next to the phone is the invitation, and there's the hand that comes into the shot and hesitates between the phone and the invitation.
Foreshadowing!
Yes, and then the phone, and then the hand takes the invitation and makes off with it. And we get John Cusack there at the door with the roses, and she hands them to her, and she says, I'll go put these in some rubbing alcohol.
great, yeah.
Which is nice.
And then another instance where he tries to tell somebody what he does for a living, and he just laughs and goes, ah, good for you, it's a growth industry. And just John Cusack's face of, okay.
Oh, you mean when he goes to talk to the dad?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just drunk already, and... pounds some more scotch and then goes back to reading whatever the hell he was reading.
Yeah, he seems remarkably unfazed for somebody that, like, you know, even he mentions, like, the fact that he went missing destroyed his daughter. So he seems pretty okay with them going out and hanging out.
Well, he clearly thinks she did some growing up in the meantime, because he says, I don't know why you left. I don't know why you abandoned my daughter, but it's good you left. I'm glad you did. And he's like, all right, that's a very nice way to say hello after 10 years. Appreciate that.
It's an odd scene, but it's mostly there to establish the fact that that's her dad. And for other reasons later on. then we go to the reunion, and Arlene is an irritating human being. And I just love it that she's so proud of everything about her that she's done for this reunion. She's only there, and this reunion is full of these characters that we meet for like 2 seconds, who all speak to a certain archetype of people that you meet at reunions. You will find these same people in Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion, among other places. It's just the kind of assortment that you usually have. It's the you know, person who throws herself into being like perfect at school stuff and has grown up to do perfect stuff and organize the event and all that. And then there's the people who have gone on to have car dealerships, or they're lawyers, or all this other stuff.
Computer guy.
Yeah. a lawyer with a pen, the penultimate pen. It's weird, like, just passes around and meets people. Jenna Elfman in a neck brace.
Yes.
Jeremy Piven is there again and says, you look Tony Robbins good.
Go back to Jenna Elfman for a minute. I love that her long, drawn-out story about all of these things that she saw in heaven, and then they're like, how did you die? She's just like, I lost it on some ice and ended up in Lake St. Clair. And another one of my favorite lines, just the, oh, you want to go somewhere else? Just walk away.
Yeah, it seemed a little unsubtle, but nice. Yeah. And so we also get the baby when they separate for a second, and she goes off to meet Amy the Lush from before, and he goes and runs into this woman who brought her child to the high school reunion full of alcohol and drunk people. Horrible mother. And they have this moment where there's 5,000 different cuts of John Cusack and this baby staring at one another. signifying that he's missed out on something and really wants to have a kid, which is...
I mean, it was a pretty adorable baby, though, so I let it go.
Yeah, right. Like, it would have been smiling if the music was that loud.
You can tell that they shot it with two cameras, too, because he does the same little smiley face thing twice. But, yeah, you know, working with kids. What are you going to get?
Yeah, especially a baby that late at night. And so...
you know, they probably didn't shoot that at night.
I know.
Okay.
Just movie magic. I'm joking. and we get the weird scene where he leads Minnie Driver off after they've met the baby. He leads Minnie Driver off down the hall, this darkened corridor, to the nurse's room, to the nurse's office.
You mean where they go make a baby?
Yeah. And I was just like, this is a weird fantasy. Just like to go in there with the... the mumps and the chicken pox and like God knows what is in that room. And you're just like,
how many kids in high school do you know have the mumps?
I'm hopefully none, but with the way that people in Los Angeles are refusing to vaccinate their children, probably more. But
1996 Detroit, I think, was probably not quite so bad.
Yeah, I know. Third rail. And moving right along, that was a questionable choice. And then they're kissing in the hallway on their way out again and stuff. And we get the Basque terrorist guy.
You skipped right over Bob DiStefalo. You don't even care about Bob DiStefalo?
Oh.
The conflicted BMW dealership owner who writes poetry on the side?
I thought that was on the way back.
No, it was right after they come out of the nurse's room.
Oh, right. I'm thinking of when he confronts him in the hallway afterwards. Yeah, so... Bob DiStefalo.
You think he's just going to be a stereotypical jackass BMW person? unlike any of our listeners, I swear.
I don't think Casey listens. It's fine.
No, not at all. but, you know, he sells BMWs. It's his dad's dealership. He's clearly a jackass. But I love that he's more of a human being than you would have expected because he's clearly depressed alcoholic who writes poetry in his free time. And he really actually missed John Cusack. He just doesn't know how to express it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was weird.
For a while.
Yes. Oh, boy. And we get the Basque assassin picks up the other guy's name from Arlene, and Arlene's all like, oh, I love him, and that's great, Arlene.
It is I, Sidney Feldman, because who talks like that?
Yeah, she's like, oh, you spent some time over in Europe.
Yes.
Oh, boy. But the weird thing is Minnie Driver's like, oh, I want to say goodbye to people. And he's like, well, I don't want to talk to them. So I'm going to go over by my locker. Meet me over there. And he wanders off and finds the thing in his locker, the old joint that crumbles to dust or whatever that was. And
That's what it was.
Okay. Well, I mean, I was assuming. I didn't want to be rolling paper normative. But for some reason, the assassin finds him there, even though I don't know what would lead him to be in the hallway. And immediately they go into attack mode. And it's a very drawn out big battle with the really weird music selection of the saxophone stuff. I don't understand it. It's an actual song. It's not just something they composed for the moment. I mean, it goes along with the 80s theme of perfect music that they had for the high school reunion, but it's very strange for this fight. And they break it all down, and our wonderful Basque friend is dead. C'est la vie.
I thought it was a pretty good fight scene, and I even thought the music worked pretty well for it.
Well, I mean, I was fine with the fight. I found the saxophone just a little jarring.
It's a fight scene in which somebody ends up dead. Like, what are you looking for?
I don't know, cable guy. Anyway, so moving right along, that happened, and Minnie Driver walks in because she was gonna meet him at the locker, and she's like, "Oh God, you killed somebody!" And you know, they have a moment, and she leaves. She can't deal with that, but doesn't call the cops or anything or tell anybody at the event. Just leaves, and Jeremy Piven wanders in, and they buddy-buddy maneuver the dead body out into the furnace downstairs, which is fantastic. And then Jeremy Piven is a little shell-shocked from that, and they go grab a drink at the mostly closed-down reunion.
Okay, and this is where I thought you were going to protest the music, because this is one of my favorite music cues in the movie, is 99 Red Balloons playing while they're wrapping up the body and running him like Scooby-Doo mystery style around the corners and then through the basement and then into the fire.
Oh, no, I loved all that.
Oh, God. Like, after I saw this movie back whenever it was, probably, I think, when it was new, ever since then, anytime I hear that song, that scene is all I think about.
Well, whenever I hear 99 Love Balloons, I only think about the scene in Watchmen where she's going to meet the owl at... right along.
No, I remember that. But, yeah, this being the first time...
Of course, this predates that, and I never saw this movie.
For sure.
I'm sure I would have had the same thing, and I would have been watching Watchmen with thinking of the scene of Dr. Manhattan or Rorschach bundled up in a little red, carried away. And so that was nice.
He draws his face on the high school banners with blood.
Oh,
it's a disturbing image.
Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome.
And so that's great. And he calls Alan Arkin from his hotel room and fires him because Alan Arkin wasn't serious about their therapy. Which,
and this is where he's already in the session with some crying woman sitting on the floor, and he's just so angry that he's literally smashing his phone trying to get it to shut up.
Yes, it was quite amusing. And Minnie Driver shows back up at his hotel for some reason, and they have a
conversation. She needs answers.
Yes, and they have a conversation. He's, you know, she's all like, "You don't get to have me, don't you get it?" Which is an interesting line.
You can't gloss over this. There are dozens of great lines in this scene here.
Okay. Well,
people joke about the horrible things they don't do. They don't do them. It's insane.
Mm-hmm.
I took the psych profile. My results fit a certain moral flexibility would be the only way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you're, no. Psychopath kills for no reason. I kill for money. It's a job. It didn't sound right. Hang on. But then after she says that and tries to storm out, he says, "You're overreacting." And I love that she just says, "Yeah, I know I am," and she continues to storm out.
It's nice. I liked it. It was an interesting scene. I mean, at this point in the movie, you're either with the fact that they're going to have a loving relationship by the end of this film, or you're not with the fact that they're going to have a loving relationship at the end of this film. And it's regardless of whatever happens here, you know? You're either bought into the fact that she's going to wind up being okay with him being a killer or having been a killer, or they're never going to get together. And knowing that the way things are going in this movie, it seemed more likely that they would wind up together at the end of this.
True, but either way, this scene along with all the others, they still felt like real people doing things that real people might do in this scene to me.
I cannot fathom going into a hotel room of a known killer and telling them, "Maybe this isn't going to work and I'm overreacting to you killing someone," and then leaving.
Well, clearly she wanted more of an explanation than what she saw for 2 seconds before sprinting out. And clearly she has enough of a past relationship with him to give him at least the opportunity to explain himself.
Yeah, I guess she wanted some closure. I still would have called the cops. That's my only contention is like, that really feels a little far-fetched for, like, a normal human reaction. Because it's not like they've been together for 10 years and then she finds out about this thing about him and then still tries to make it work. It's like they haven't been together at all for 10 years. They've been together for, like, what, 36 hours, 24 hours, something?
Yeah, but you're still discounting the intensity of their former relationship.
That was 10 years ago. And she got married since then. Remember?
Right, but again, clearly, based on how dramatic their reconnection was, again, the moment they see each other, they start kissing, there's clearly enough there that she's willing to give him a chance almost in spite of anything he could possibly do.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, is like, in this film, you either have to be okay on board with that, or it's not going to work.
Yeah, totally on board.
Yeah, but you can be on board with that happening in this movie and still not say that it's something that would happen in real life, which is where I'm at, in that I don't think this is real, but that I'm on board with it in the logic of the film, that that's fine. In this film universe, it's okay.
You just don't believe that they could be soulmates?
I don't believe in love, Dan.
That's very clear coming through from this conversation.
Yes. I mean, from every conversation we ever had. When have I been like, oh, this is such a charming moment? Screw it.
I know for a fact you have a heart.
Yes, 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 yes. Sure. Fine. Whatever. And then, you know, we get the whole scene of Joan destroying the office, which I love.
Smoking, pouring gas everywhere.
I know. Smoking a cigarette, pouring gasoline from a canister on the floor. And then for some reason, she takes a hammer and gently raps at the side of her Power Mac.
Yeah, she's going to enjoy smashing her computers and destroying the place.
Oh my God, it was so silly.
And then answers the phone, I'm taking down the office right now. What a lovely way to put it.
It's funny. I love her arson. And that's why I kind of want like a whole movie of just like her antics as like a crazy secretary that works for insane people.
Oh, totally. She'd be a great spin-off movie for sure.
Oh yeah, all of the crazy shit that she does just to like as part of her job, but then still makes it work in sort of like her temp secretary office administrator kind of life of like going home and having her Stouffer's French pizza frozen French pizza stuff. Like that stuff. I want to see that movie. That would be hilarious. Which is why I don't understand your criticism from earlier that she was your least favorite.
No, it was just her performance as an actor. I'm not saying her character is fantastic.
I mean,
even in this scene too, I love it. He says, "I'll make things right, and then I'll come find you." And her first reaction is, "Oh God, why?" No, it's not like that.
Yeah. Well, she is gifted with the lovely emergency stash of dollar bills from underneath the desk.
Like $100,000 in cash or something.
Yeah, she's quite happy about it.
Hangs up and she just cheers out loud.
Yeah, it's great. And he finally thinks maybe I should actually look inside of the envelope of who I'm supposed to go kill. Because there is no way that would be anybody in the film that we've seen up to this point. And of course it is. It is Minnie Driver's father that we met briefly. We don't get that reveal of him looking at the papers and realizing that. But of course, we just immediately cut to him jogging, the father jogging, and he's in gun sights of Dan Aykroyd and his hitman goon squad union in their van. What I don't understand, though, is he's jogging towards this van that has its side door open.
Yeah.
Parked perpendicular to the street. It just seems like if you were just jogging, why wouldn't you be like, oh, this is a little weird. Oh, why is that guy wearing an all-black suit? And what's that glinty metal thing?
He's an old man. Maybe his eyesight's not good. No, this is, yeah. It's clearly a moment where the directing had to have something happen, and they couldn't really figure out a way to have it happen that kind of made sense. So, I mean, you had to have John Cusack come sliding up in his town car and save the day.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but, boy. Yeah. Yeah, and the part that bothers me about when he looked in the envelope is he stares at it for a good 30 seconds before he says his line, realizing what's going on. But when he drops it for just a moment, you can see that he's looking at a picture instead of, like, reading something.
Mm-hmm.
And I so would have preferred if it would have been text and he was reading something and going, oh, I finally got to the part with the name, and now I realize what's going on, rather than looking at somebody's face who he has presumably seen hundreds of times.
Well, there's a whole packet of information, so...
Yeah. They just should have put, like, something with text on the top, but... I don't know.
It didn't really... Minor gripe. The package wasn't that important at that point. It was just there to convey the one plot point of what we need to go do next. And, because if it had been anybody else, if it was Jeremy Piven, or if it was, you know, Bill or Bob or whatever, or any of the lawyer or Jenna Elfman or anybody else, then he wouldn't probably have cared at all about foiling it. It needed to be Minnie Driver or Minnie Driver's dad, and of course it was the dad.
Well, I guess, but I mean, I honestly couldn't say I would know how he would react if it was somebody else, because the reason I like this scene, again, is because there's more to it than just what it looks like, because... He's clearly decided to take down his business because he's done with it, because it's ruining everything that he's trying to do, trying to recover his life. But at the same time, Minnie Driver is, you know, for all he knows, she'll never speak to him again. But this is all he knows. This is all he's ever known. And this is just, it's sitting in front of him. So his natural fallback curiosity is to just say, well, this is this is all I got. This is the only thing around me that could potentially be something to take my mind off of everything that is going horribly wrong. So he decides to dig into it. Like, his motivation for looking into it and what he might do as a result, I think he's really just opening it because he has literally nothing else in his life that he could do to distract himself. And again, once he sees it, that sort of kicks him back into gear to say, no, you better get off your butt and go save this guy, because you know, because Dan Aykroyd stated in a previous scene that he's going to do his job and then do another job.
Yeah. Well, and it has a lot to do probably with Dan Aykroyd, because we've clearly established the animosity between these two characters by this point in the movie. And that it will, that what started as sort of like a friendly rivalry, has escalated, in every scene they've met each other in. And so naturally now they're going to actually come to it, that it's all going to come to a head. And yeah, they, for some reason set up in a, busted colonial home and decide to decide that's the best defensible position they could muster, and God bless them.
Well, like you said, the way their relationship goes south throughout the course of the movie, this is something that when done right in movies works out great, because clearly when he tells Dan Aykroyd that this is his last job because he's lost his taste for it, he doesn't believe him one bit, because they've had their animosity in the past. But we as the audience, we know something that Dan Aykroyd doesn't, because we've been present for the rest of the movie. And the misunderstanding that continues to escalate their relationship leads to that scene at the end, and it does a great job of it. Like, in the beginning, they're sort of ambivalent towards each other, even though they're going in separate paths. But once, you know, he's forced into this job in Detroit, and Dan Aykroyd thinks he took it from him on purpose because he doesn't want to be part of the guild, then he's mad. And, you know, it's just the way it spirals from there is, I think, expertly crafted in that Dan Aykroyd doesn't know what's been going on, and he doesn't care. He knows what he sees, and we can clearly see what he sees is John Cusack screwing with him and trying to, you know, screw over his side business thing going on there, and he's pissed about it.
Yeah, and this works out really well after we get the first few henchmen out of the way. And I literally say out of the way because they are utterly meaningless. And it doesn't make any sense how they attack. It doesn't matter. It just sort of like softens them up.
Yeah. I do like the little side plot where he's like passing out his super antidepressants before they go do their job. Like the fact that he's maybe a little nuts is one thing, but then they're passing around these drugs that are just like super happy fun pills. Let's go kill somebody. It's like, good Lord, the things these people do to deal with their job.
Yeah. Well, they won't have to worry about it much longer. So they're just going to be on a toxicology report. They get killed, and we're left with the battle between him and Dan Aykroyd, which is interesting because maybe don't have everyone attack one at a time in a house that's entirely made of wood and glass. Just mow on through it. And there are wood and glass doors literally like on every wall of this home. So just,
well,
break
he's
in.
He's running around. They're spreading out to try and surround him. There's only like five of them. I didn't have a huge problem with that.
So after they're done attacking one at a time, and then it's Dan Aykroyd, and they're shooting at each other from over this wood and ceramic tile peninsula in the kitchen.
They're just shooting to make noises too, to scare one another. And I love the fact that despite being professionals for many years, that they're still just like, they're winging it basically. They have no idea what's going on.
Well, particularly when we as the, I as an audience member was thinking, gee, there were a lot of gun fire moments here with bullets. Maybe, just maybe, shooting every 2 seconds at nothing is probably not a good idea if you have a certain limited number of bullets.
It's cover fire.
Cover fire for what? Like, how you're going to run out of bullets?
Well, you know, he's trying to look for a place to hide and figure out what's going to happen next. And then, I mean, it's never like where they're in like an old Western where one's hiding behind a rock and the other one's hiding behind another rock and they're just sort of shooting at each other. They end up in that position very briefly and they're constantly moving. And then as soon as they do stop in that one position where they decide to talk to each other is when our NSA guys kick the door in and it's like, well, we got to deal with this now.
which I thought was okay. The thing where they break in the door, I thought was strange, because it seemed also tactically unsound.
Well, I think they just basically heard the cease of bullets, and they thought maybe whatever was going on had stopped.
Yeah, but they're glass doors. Just look in the glass doors.
There were curtains on the door.
Oh, yes, those thin, lacy curtains. It's impenetrable. And there's windows everywhere. So anyway, they break in the French doors, and there they are, standing there, just standing, like, chests facing forward for whoever's on the other side of that door. Whoever trained them was an idiot.
They clearly haven't been the most intelligent NSA agents up until this point.
No, but it also doesn't make any sense why they're there now, at this point in the movie.
Well, that was their whole plan. They were going to wait till he kills the dad, and then they were going to kill him.
Yes, except that clearly something else has been happening, and they would have stepped over the bodies outside and seen that something else has been happening before they got in here. And sure enough, Dan Aykroyd, a character who had been, in a way, assisting them, or they had been, in a way, cooperating with previously, winds up shooting them in the chest and killing them. totally remorseless.
I think at this point he's just, you know, he's a psychotic person in general, but at this point he's just, he's going for broke. Like, I mean, if he has the opportunity to kill everybody, including John Cusack and the NSA guys, why not?
Yeah, except I don't understand.
Something else for his resume.
Yeah, but if these are the NSA guys that work well with you, why would you kill them and risk having NSA guys that don't work well with you?
Who knows? Anyway. I'm not entirely certain that even Dan Aykroyd's character would know why he's doing it.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just reflexes, and then he was like, oh, well. But who knows?
He's in the middle of a moment with Martin, and these guys interrupted, and he's not in the mood.
Yeah, well, it was just odd. But, I mean, it wasn't the point of the movie. Clearly, the NSA plot of this movie was not going to go anywhere. They were sort of there ambiently through the entire thing, and it wasn't really, like, a plan in place with them, really, other than the fact that they were going to be there. So it's fine. And they're dead. And c'est la vie. But Dan Aykroyd and John Cusack quickly realize they are out of ammo. And they start talking again. It's like, oh, well, you come upstairs with the old man, and we'll kill him, and you can still be part of my union, and blah, 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 blah. John Cusack realizes, hey, there's this giant CRT television here.
yeah, CRT TVs have a purpose.
Yes. Maybe I will kill and somehow electrocute somebody with an unplugged television. And proceeds...
He unplugged it, okay? You can see it happen.
I know, but that's what I'm saying is, like, he unplugs it, clearly. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been hurtled over the counter very well. And then hurtles it over the counter, hitting Dan Aykroyd in the face and knocking Dan Aykroyd to the ground with a CRT monitor on him. And then Dan Aykroyd proceeds to twitch while electrical noises are recorded. It didn't make a lot of sense. Like, there's
pretty sure CRTs have capacitors, yeah.
Yeah, they have capacitors in them, but it shouldn't electrocute you dead.
You're saying they don't have 220-volt capacitors in them?
I wouldn't be able to tell you the voltage that would kill a human being. I just found it implausible, yeah. Especially the prolonged twitching for several minutes.
The part that I found implausible is the fact that the CRT glass was able to be crushed or to able to break on his head, because if you've ever tried to break a CRT, that glass is really thick.
Is that another one of those activities that your dad got mad at you for?
No. But I would tell you that that would probably break Dan Aykroyd's skull before it would break on his skull.
Okay. Well, that's also a valid point. Valid criticism. So basically, CRTs as a killing weapon, no. Not a good idea.
I mean, if you're out of bullets and you're about to be shot, I mean, go for it. Why not?
Yeah, watch it bounce off their head. And so anyway, everybody's dead now. And then he nonchalantly goes upstairs and asks for her hand in marriage. And the dad's like, you got my blessing. So good job, sir.
Yeah, we missed a couple other cute little moments that I enjoy in this movie. When they first hide in the bathtub and she says, make this gun work, and he cocks it for her and hands it back. And she's just clearly so stunned that she's pointing it right at his face. And he just kind of like gently nudges it out of the way so the gun isn't pointing right in his face while he says, wait here, I'll be right back.
Yeah.
I love those moments in this movie.
Mm, it was okay.
There's a ton of them.
Yeah. I mean, I liked it better when he was asking Dan Aykroyd if they were going to have meetings at the union. And he said, yeah, sure. And he says, what was it he said? Like, I hate meetings, or I can't stand meetings.
This union, they're going to be meetings? Of course. No meetings. And then he just starts shooting at him.
Yes. It was very nice. So it's fine. And then we get the weird thing of the music kicking in at the radio station and her pre-recorded voice on reel-to-reel tape. And they're driving out of town in a Saab convertible to destination unknown. It's very strange. She apparently got over the fact that he was a killer and is cool with just spending his blood money now on their vacation.
I mean, it's kind of in her voiceover explaining that, you know, sometimes life is strange. Sometimes you just got to let it go and move on.
Yeah, you gotta let the blood money go and move on. I mean, what's it gonna be like? They're gonna be like, oh yeah, what does your husband do for a living? Oh, nothing. We're just living off of our retirement funds. Oh, really? How did he make it big? Oh, you know, military stuff, investing, that kind of thing.
It's all very technical.
Yes.
Yes. Potentially, in the future, they might have to explain their means, but you know, again, idyllic movie relationship. She clearly is willing to try and work past all of the difficulties that they have had before to pursue this relationship that was very meaningful to the both of them.
It just seemed very strange to me that she was so okay with it all of a sudden.
She's not okay with it, that's the point, but she wants to try.
Okay enough to try, I guess, would probably be another way of looking at it.
Okay enough to not write off somebody that she clearly still loves.
Whatever, I write people off all the time.
Apparently.
Mm-hmm. And so that takes us to the conclusion where we get our nice series of shots that mirror the series of shots of him entering the town, of them leaving, and the aerial shot next to the water of the them driving off to destination unknown. So that's fantastic. Good for them.
Yep. Happy ending. Happy ending.
Yeah.
I like this movie.
That's fine. It's good.
I skipped over so many quotes that I love. Like, I mean, there's probably like 12 lines just from the diner scene with the Nada omelet.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to just read off the IMDb quotes page now, Dan?
No. I wrote these down myself while I was watching it today.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Pooch puncher.
Mm.
Hound hitter.
Mm.
Poodle pumper. He's clearly having too much fun just rubbing it in. He's like, you know what? That's not funny.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice dog. These idiots killed the dog, not me.
Mm-hmm. He's a retriever, so he retrieved.
Yeah, dynamite.
Yeah. So that was sad. Poor dog.
Poor dog.
Poor. What was his name?
Boudreaux.
Yeah. Cujo. So that was.
And then Dan Aykroyd laughs at him because he knows the dog's name. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, clearly he's not super thrilled that the dog accidentally died.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, obviously, he thinks it's amusing because it's the kind of thing that Dan Aykroyd's character, would not bother remembering about a hit.
For sure. It's just, the way this movie balances real people, real characters, some serious things that some serious people, like actual people might have to deal with, and the comedy and the interaction between the characters is just, I love this movie. I never get tired of watching it.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
It's a good one. I enjoy this.
Good stuff.
Egg white omelet. Two poached eggs. Scrape off the milky white stuff. I'm just going off of memory now on these ones.
Okay.
What do you like in your omelet?
Well, funny you should mention that. For breakfast this morning, I made omelets. And it was a Gruyere cheese. And it was the thin French style omelets, not the gross thick diner omelets. So it was very fancy.
Aren't those called crepes?
No. Because a crepe is that's batter. It's a pink. This is an omelet, like it's eggs. It's just thin. You know the difference, right?
I know. I'm messing with you.
Yeah. So it was Gruyere. I didn't even know omelets were in the movie. So I found that fascinating.
Just cheese? That's it?
Yeah, just cheese.
Ah.
I mean, I don't have an omelet station set up at my at my place where I'm just, you know, making omelets for people.
Pretty sure there's another late night infomercial product that you could buy to make omelets real quick and easy.
Wasn't there one? It was like folded over. It was like some weird microwave tray. You'd pour it in and then you'd like fold it on top of the other thing. Oh God.
Yeah, you remember the egg wave?
I don't remember that.
It was a way to make hard boiled eggs in the microwave.
Ugh. You really should not make that in the microwave.
No, they came out looking like the eggs that come on Egg McMuffins. I mean, at least in the commercial, I never actually owned one.
I don't like hard boiled eggs. Which means I don't. Yeah, I don't like them. Which means I don't like egg salad. I find it.
Oh God, no, egg salad, no.
That's repulsive. Just the smell of it. Ugh.
Okay, and here's where I'm going to alienate some more listeners. Egg salad, chicken salad, just both of them. Get them away forever. Just never. Don't eat that garbage.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with you for a second here. Good chicken salad I like, and by good chicken salad I mean not that mushy garbage that looks like tuna fish salad.
yeah, tuna salad can go away as well.
Okay, I think we just alienated everybody. Because
what is it? You take your protein of choice, you shred it up, you throw in like mayonnaise and celery, isn't it?
Well, not always, and especially with like chicken, you can make a Waldorf chicken salad. Where it's got, you know, like the little grapes that are sliced up and some apple and walnuts. It's very nice.
A chicken salad is one of those things. I'm sure there's probably an edible fashion of chicken salad, but I refuse. On principle, chicken salad is an abomination.
Okay, so no chicken salad in your burrito.
No, never. I have contemplated sending an email to Marco about that because of how often he talks about how much he loves chicken salad.
Why? Leave him alone.
It's so bad.
You don't know that. You haven't had his chicken salad.
There is no chicken salad good enough for me to consider.
So chicken saladist of you.
From the man who has no heart when it comes to actual emotions, you'll defend chicken salad.
To the death I will. It's fine. It's just food. Who cares?
These are people's lives we're talking about, and you're more concerned about chicken salad.